This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
Top-notch, value-added, hot-off-the-presses news.
Bloomberg puts out thousands of news stories a day, but some really stick with you.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day from over 150 news bureaus around the world.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter on this edition of Bloomberg Best.
Vanguard founder Jack Bogle gives his advice on investing today.
We don't know a lot, okay? Let's be honest about that. But what we do know is the yield you get today has a very high correlation with the total return you'll get in the next decade. Everybody, investors, should always look way ahead and not try and speculate on what happens today or tomorrow.
Jose Gonzalez-Anaya gives us his outlook for Pemex.
We had to make some very deep cuts and some very important cuts. And I call these adjustments the short-term challenge. And we're facing a short-term challenge that is very big. But Pemex is facing a very good long-term opportunity.
And Carolyn Look discusses the increase in European border checkpoints and who they're hurting most.
If you go to the border checkpoints between Austria and Germany, for instance, like we did, what we saw was that there's just, you know, huge queues of traffic. And what we've heard from truckers is that they've had to wait up to 4 hours in traffic. And you can imagine that has an impact.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
The two presidential frontrunners rebounded last night in the New York primaries, bringing some sense of normalcy to the very tumultuous presidential race.
Normalcy, huh, June? For more on the race, I spoke with Mark Niket, a Bloomberg politics reporter, to discuss the importance of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's home state victories and what they mean for the summer's party conventions. So, Mark, big win. Let's start with the Democrats. Big win for Hillary Clinton. Turned out larger, actually, than some of the polling just before and even during the vote count, the exits. How big is the win?
Well, right now with 99% counted, there's still some straggler votes out there, but it's 58% to 42% for Hillary Clinton. As you said, much bigger than even the polls suggested, and I think even that the Sanders campaign had been expecting. I think they thought it would be closer than it turned out to be.
Yes, Sanders' camp almost sounding resigned. You have a really nice story up on the Bloomberg saying that he's decided to stay until every vote is counted. But am I reading between the lines, do you think, correctly, or the tea leaves? They have to be a bit frustrated.
I think they were. Like I said, I think they were thrown a little bit by these results. It wasn't the margin, I don't think, is what they were expecting at all. And you had conflicting messages coming from the Sanders campaign. You had Jeff Weaver, his campaign manager, sort of saying on the network shows that Sanders was going to fight till the convention, and he was going to try and, you know, persuade the superdelegates to switch their allegiances. And you had Tad Devine, who's the media strategist for Senator Sanders, saying, well, we're going to see what happens with the next wave of primaries here and assess, you know, where we're going. I think it's clear he's going to stay in this, and he certainly has the money to stay in the race until the convention. But the question now is going to be, how aggressively does he campaign? And I think the Clinton campaign is concerned, you know, how aggressively does he target her or criticize her going forward?
And it is delegates, and she was in a good position before. Now, where do we stand?
Well, she has a commanding lead, again, much bigger than the lead that Barack Obama had over Hillary Clinton when they had their 2008 primary. And it's getting to the point where it's just mathematically going to be, you know, next to impossible for Senator Sanders to catch up, particularly when you include the superdelegates. In fact, the Clinton campaign thinks we're going to have five primaries coming up on Tuesday in the Northeast, including Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And if Hillary Clinton performs as well as she did in New York, certainly, and as the polls indicate, she probably will, their feeling is her lead will be all but surmountable by that point.
GOP, Donald Trump saying, I was actually a little surprised and then sat back and said, no, in his acceptance speech, he says basically he has it in the bag that the nomination is his. Is it?
I don't think so. I mean, there's still some drama to be played out on the Republican side. As you said, you know, Donald Trump was sort of claiming the mantle of victor and, you know, let's move on. And he does have an advantage now that Senator Ted Cruz is mathematically incapable of getting the majority of delegates before the convention. So now only Donald Trump has a shot to get the 1,237 delegates needed for the nomination before the party's convention in Cleveland. But it's no sure thing. He'll have to win, I think, 57% of all remaining delegates to get to that number. And of course, Ted Cruz and John Kasich, who remain in the race, their goal now is going to be and has been to stop Donald Trump from getting to that majority of delegates before the convention, which would force this open convention where they would hope that after multiple ballots, somebody besides Donald Trump could become the nominee.
Yeah, so Cruz and Kasich are basically acting now as delegate blockers in their own self-interest there. What do you think the feeling is now, because Trump is recruiting more GOP establishment, if we can characterize it that way? Is he trying to be more presidential, trying to get the establishment to go in there and say, hey, guys, if I have all these delegates, you can't turn me down at the convention?
I think so. I mean, you're seeing sort of two tracks with the Trump campaign right now. You're still seeing sort of the blustery, boisterous Donald Trump calling the system rigged and, you know, suggesting that the Republican National Committee is somehow trying to steal the nomination from him. But on the other hand, you're also seeing Donald Trump kind of pivot a little bit and, like you said, act a little more presidential. The thinking is, you know, he's kind of retooled his campaign a little bit. He brought in Paul Manafort, who is a veteran of the 76 contested convention. He brought in Rick Wiley, who was Governor Scott Walker's campaign manager. And I think the feeling is they are trying to reshape the campaign to be a little more presidential, at least be less of sort of the lightning rod for controversy that it has been. Now we're getting to the point where I think he realizes he needs to be appearing as he can be president and act more presidential.
That was Mark Niket, a reporter for Bloomberg Politics.
If you want to read more political news from Bloomberg, go to BloombergPolitics.com.
Coming up, investing icon Jack Bogle gives us an overview of financial markets.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg Best is brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. To them, every day is Earth Day. They're committed to bringing higher finance to lower carbon. Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner & Smith, member SIPC.
Investors have long been torn between active and passive investing, debating whether it's best to trust their own stock-picking skills or the market's efficiency.
Mm-hmm. Well, now one notable investor is lending his voice to this debate. Jack Bogle, founder of Vanguard and author of Common Sense on Mutual Funds. Bogle spoke with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Michael McKee on Bloomberg Surveillance.
What a year. What a 2015 for the choice between active and passive management. What was different this year?
I think what's happening in this past, this year being 2016 and 2015 were years where the index vastly outperformed, the S&P 500 vastly outperformed, not only the average fund, but the most fair comparison is the typical large blend fund, a large mutual fund that has some growth stocks and some value stocks, roughly half and half. And last year, the S&P margin was, I think, about 2.5%. And this year, the S&P is already ahead. It's up 3.5%, and the average fund is up 2%. So in just 3 months, or 3.5 months, that gain is still very large. It's partly good fortune. I want to make that very clear. When large stocks do better than small and mid caps, the S&P is going to have an advantage. But even when you look at it, Tom, with its own group, that large blend group I mentioned, it's going to do. The large blend group is up 2.5, so it's fully a percentage point ahead of them.
Is it hard to say who's going to perform? Is it hard to pick a sector or a market cap that is going to perform these days?
I think it's always been hard. One thing we investors do, is look backward and see who has done the best in the past. That's a very human trait. It tells you nothing. Indeed, it may give you exactly the wrong answer, and that is to say funds that have done very well in the past turn out not to do very well in the future. It's called reversion to the mean, and the statistics show that you're just as wise to pick a fund out of the have just as small an opportunity to get into the top quintile of funds if you pick from the past top quintile or the past bottom quintile, both about 15% of the funds there, make it into the top quintile the next period. So the odds are just terrible, and it doesn't matter. Past performance doesn't matter or gives you a negative signal. So I think that's one reason why the index is doing so well. It takes, there are a lot of brokers out there selling it now through ETFs. There are a lot of registered investment advisors. And the index is safe. It's a safe choice. You won't be elated by the returns, but you won't be disappointed by them.
Tom raised some good points about what's going on in the fixed income market with bond portfolios these days, Jack. And I wanted to follow up on that. And is there reason to be concerned in this kind of environment?
Well, what we know is we don't know a lot. Okay, let's be honest about that. But what we do know is the yield you get today has a very high correlation with the total return you'll get in the next decade. And everybody, investors, should always look way ahead and not try and speculate on what happens today or tomorrow. And the yields are low. Our total bond market fund yields, I think, around 2.2%. Our intermediate term bond index yields about 2.7%, because it has less governments in it. And that's the kind of yields you're able to get. Now, they are very low yields historically, no question about that. But the reality is that the historic yields had about a 3%, 3.5% inflation rate into them, and today the inflation rate is close to zero. So looking at yields on a real basis after inflation, they're really not that far from the yields over the long term.
Okay. Jack, this is really important. Should our listeners take risk in equities, or should they be in bonds for less volatility?
I like owning bonds for less volatility, but I don't like volatile bond funds. And what drags that particular fund, I think I know which one you're talking about, what drags them down in sharp ratio, risk-adjusted return, is they may have a good return, but they also have a high risk. And I don't think this is any time to take risk on the bond side of the portfolio. There's plenty of risk on the stock side of the portfolio. And so I think you can't eliminate risk on the bond side, but you want to minimize it.
That was Jack Bogle, founder of Vanguard, talking with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Michael McKee on Bloomberg Surveillance.
Coming up, after an 11-year oil output slump, Pemex's new CEO is trying to turn the company around.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on Iran's economy with Bloomberg's Cambiz Forahar.
The situation.
Nuclear sanctions were lifted in January, but let me emphasize that this is only the nuclear-related sanctions. Other sanctions on terrorism and human rights are still in place. And Iran economy is getting massive boost because of this. The sanctions are being lifted. Iran can sell its oil on their markets. Has great access to its own currencies from the sale of this oil sales than before. And IMF expects Iran's economy to grow around 5.5% this year and next.
The background.
Well, Iran's economy boomed when the oil price hit around $100, and it benefited greatly from that price hike. But once the sanctions start kicking in around 2010, 2012, the economy sort of tanked, I would say, and they contracted by about 6%.
The argument.
Well, argument four is that this is a booming economy and that's a great opportunity. Against investing is that U.S. investors cannot really invest in Iran at the moment because of sanctions. So that's a big argument against investing.
For more on Iran's economy or other quick takes, go to BloombergView.com/quicktake, or for terminal customers, go to NI Quick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter.
2 years after Mexico passed sweeping energy reforms, the new CEO of Petróleos Mexicanos is rushing to turn around Mexico's troubled oil giant, which has been in an 11-year slump.
José Antonio González Anaya discussed the turnaround with Bloomberg's Eric Schatzker, who started off by asking him what assets the oil giant was willing to give up in order to turn profitable.
we're prepared to talk about and put on the table non-strategic assets. Pemex was a vertically integrated monopoly for 75 years. So there are a lot of things that within the new rules are not, they don't necessarily have to be run by Pemex.
Well, I can imagine that might be a fertilizer company that Pemex bought, for example. It could be some midstream type of assets. Refining, is that open to sale?
That's open to partnerships, yes.
But not outright sale?
Well, we're going to want to retain part of the equity, but we don't have to retain the majority. We're open to having a partner in which he wants to have.
A majority operator,
yes.
In refining and where else?
In the entire structure, from upstream to refining to downstream.
Everything. Are you in talks currently with any potential buyers?
Yeah, some of them. And I would like to call them partners rather than buyers. There's the two kinds. There's both of those. But I like to call them potential partners.
Now, when we talk about potential partners, are we talking about financial partners or are we talking about oil companies?
Both.
And the oil companies are from where?
They're from everywhere. Oil companies tend to be all over the world.
They are global by nature.
And it's interesting because they are very interested in Mexico, but they're very interested in Pemex. Oil companies don't like to go into a country without a domestic partner. And Pemex is a good domestic partner.
You said Pemex has a lot of room left to cut on the operating side. Where?
Well, there's a lot of inefficiencies that we're still running in the company, and we're going to go through them. We could improve our procurement practices. We could improve our negotiating practices with which we find specialized equipment. There's room to maneuver, I think.
What about jobs?
Well, I am very conscious about one thing. Jobs is not an end in itself. Job cutting is not an end in itself.
No, but it is a sign of efficiency. For example,
profitability is the end of the game.
Yes, that's true. ExxonMobil produces twice as much oil as Pemex with half as many employees. And they have big refining operations too, and midstream.
Well, Let me say this. We will take the labor decisions that we need to take based on profitability. And let me counter your example very quickly. If the wage bill for Pemex is only 50 billion pesos, so that would only take care of half of our cut for this year. So we have to do it. We are committed to becoming more efficient. But that's, you know, it's not the end game.
Understood. But part of the reason I asked the question is the alternative, besides finding other efficiencies, is to cut CapEx.
Sure.
That mortgages your future. How can that be good for Pemex? How can it be good for Mexico?
Well, I come back to the opportunity. We cut Pemex's own CapEx, but we're looking for partners, so we share the CapEx. And we're going to share the profits, but we're going to share the CapEx. And that's the key issue, and that's what makes me optimistic about the future for Pemex and for Mexico.
Jose Antonio, here's a question I'd like to ask. Something I'd like to know. What's your incentive to push for real change at Pemex? And the reason I ask is this. This company has had 8 CEOs in the past 2 decades. Why would you want to do anything risky when there's a strong likelihood that you'll be doing something else 3 or 4 years from now, just as every other Pemex CEO has?
Well, let me answer with what I did last time. I was heading the Social Security Institute, and it was insolvent. It's not insolvent anymore, and that was 3 years. So I have the same incentives. I am committed to being a good public servant, and I want to get this done. It's a big challenge. It's the biggest challenge in my professional life. And if I do it, I'll feel good about myself. It'll be good for Pemex, and more importantly, it'll be good for Mexico.
That was Pemex CEO Jose Antonio Gonzalez Anaya talking with Bloomberg's Eric Schatzker.
And coming up, with 3 decades of borderless transport coming to an end, European truckers are facing their worst nightmare.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
With a Bloomberg Business of Sports report, I'm Michael Barr. Chief Operating Officer of the Baltimore Orioles, John Angelos, on Bloomberg Radio was asked about the state of the baseball industry.
Baseball's model is a different one from football, basketball, hockey. We are a very low price point, high volume industry that really welcomes everybody under a big tent and says we have a lot of games, we have a lot of seats, and we sell about 75 million tickets a year, which is far, far more than the other three major sports leagues combined. So we're an event-driven business.
After the turndown in the economy in 2008.
And at that point, baseball redoubled its marketing efforts. I think the big challenge in front of us is competitive balance for the future. The NFL has a very elegant competitive balance system where a team in a market the size of Green Bay can compete with the New York Giants, which is a wonderful thing for fans because fans then think they're in it every year.
And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
It's 48 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg View.
I'm Megan McArdle, a columnist for Bloomberg View. We all love farm-to-table food, don't we? Or maybe we just think we love it. An exhaustive investigation by a Tampa Bay Times food critic reveals just how little of the food advertised as organic, locally sourced, non-GMO fare actually fits the description. Given the ubiquity of these anomalies, it's hard to believe there isn't considerable calculation there. And it's not hard to figure out why. Consumers don't really want to buy farm-to-table food. What they want to buy is the moral satisfaction of it. After all, if you're actually looking for farm-fresh vegetables, you probably won't be satisfied with something weeks old. On the other hand, if you're just looking for moral satisfaction, well, the nice thing about selling intangibles is there's no real difference between being told you're consuming locally grown foods and actually doing so. Restaurants shouldn't deceive their customers. Part of the reason they get away with it is people don't check. And part of the reason they do it is that most people seem unwilling to pay, in money or in limited selection, the costs of actually eating local in most of the country. If people really love farm-to-table food, they'll be checking provenance with suppliers and paying enormous premiums for their limited menus. If they just want to love the idea of it, well, they'll probably keep eating just about like they do now. I'm Megan McArdle. For more View, please go to BloombergView.com or View Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
One of the most important ideals of the European Union is the concept of free, borderless travel. But now, as the migrant crisis continues in the EU, borders are popping up once again. And that's a big problem for truckers. Bloomberg's Charlie Pellett spoke with Bloomberg reporter Carolyn Look to find out more.
What is the potential for trade if more and more of these checkpoints start cropping up and these checkpoints become more intense? What will that do for the lines of truckers waiting to cross borders?
In terms of economic impact, there's one study by the Bertelsmann Foundation that has estimated that it could cost, the union around 470 billion euros, which is around $530 billion. From gross domestic product growth, and that's across the next 10 years. In terms of individual companies, at the moment, what you're seeing is that it's mostly the transport companies that are picking up the cost, rather than it affecting the balance sheet of the companies in charge of the manufacturing. But of course, if those border checkpoints got more intense, that would definitely change.
Yeah. Are businesses then able or prepared to assume higher costs?
It's a different picture everywhere you look. But the company that we've spoken to, IBM Pabst, for instance, they were saying that it's not even a question of costs anymore. It's a matter of it just not being possible. I mean, they've completely grown around this idea that that borders will be open, and they have factories in Hungary and Czech Republic and Poland. I mean, they're expecting to be able to cross these borders without any obstacles day and night. And if you have to construct warehouses or logistics centers around these borders, it's just going to have a huge repercussion.
And what kinds of businesses rely on truck shipments from places like Poland and Hungary? What are these trucks hauling?
It could be any kind of industrial company. In the case of IBM Pabst, they make electric motors and fans. You could have auto parts. I mean, a lot of Germany's industrial heartland really relies on this elaborate just-in-time supply chain. And they take advantage of the lower costs in Hungary and Poland. And, even if you go to your local supermarket in France or in Germany, you're going to have fresh produce coming from Spain and Portugal. I mean, Europe relies on having these links with their neighbor countries.
And not just truckers, but also everyday people who commute across borders. You have people who live in one country, but work sometimes in another country.
Yeah, that's true as well. And at the moment, that doesn't seem to be as much of a problem, but it definitely could be if checkpoints were made permanent.
Does all of this then come down to resolving flows of migrants?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of pressure on both sides. I mean, on one hand, you know, you have ethical concerns about sending migrants back to Turkey. But, you know, last week you had European Union President Donald Tusk saying that the bloc also wouldn't be able to prevent political catastrophes if they don't stem these irregular migration flows. So there's really a problem.
Now, you actually spent time with some of the truckers. Tell me about that visit. Which border, and how willing were the truckers to talk to you about the problems that they're facing?
So we were at the border on the A3 between Austria and southern Germany near Bavaria, near a town called Passau. And we spoke to lots of truckers. The one we were most interested in was the one transporting parts for this company that we had interviewed. But just from our general conversations with people on the parking lot, you know, we were hearing from a lot of different truckers that that it's gotten a lot worse in the last year, that they've never had such heavy traffic jams before.
That was Carolyn Look from Bloomberg News talking with Charlie Pellett.
Officials are converging on the United Nations for this week's signing of the historic Paris Climate Pact. But is it too little, too late? Reports since the agreement was reached in December have shown that global warming may hit geological hyperspeed in decades. I spoke to Eric Ralston about whether the pact is already out of date. Eric, what's happened in the 4 months since the Paris Agreement to support doubts about the impact of the agreement?
There's two answers to the question. The first is there's been a lot of kind of depressing science about climate change. 2015, not unexpectedly, was the hottest year on record in the 135-year-old or so history of record keeping. 2014 was the one before that, the hottest year. And this year, even though we're only 3 months into it, is probably going to be the hottest year again. That's bad news. There have been a bundle of other surprising studies, really, about the speed at which the warming is going to come. The worst might come in decades rather than centuries. And West Antarctica, which holds a lot of water, over the course of the century may just gradually slide into the Southern Ocean and raise sea levels more than we had already been fearing. So that's the first answer. The Paris Agreement looks smaller than it did in December because we've had this steady stream of research. Now, the flip side, and it's not necessarily a brighter flip side, is that science takes a long time. And the fundamental understanding that scientists had and have been telling policymakers for 20 or 30 years, the basics haven't changed. Like, none of these studies that have come out this year make it any better or worse than we thought. We know this is a tremendous problem, and we know we're way behind.
I was surprised to read that. You wrote that the span of estimates for how sensitive the climate is to more carbon dioxide hasn't changed much in at least two decades. If that's the fact, then why didn't the scientific advisors in Paris know that what they were doing wasn't enough?
They did. And what governs the pace of these UN negotiations is what's politically possible, not what's scientifically encouraged. So Paris was a dramatic diplomatic victory on a scale we probably hadn't seen in 20 years. But on the other hand, what they were going for was advised, but was it was sort of limited by the politically possible and not the geophysically necessary.
What's the most important point of contention among scientists about climate change?
It's not what's generally represented in American discourse. Climate change is happening. We are the dominant cause. It's accelerating in many ways faster than scientists thought even a few years ago. I think the critical one that we would like to know with greater precision is exactly the relationship between carbon dioxide and the consequent rise in temperature. The best that the scientists can do is to provide a narrow range, and they sort of settle on about 3 degrees of climate change, of warming is what you get for a doubling of the carbon dioxide level between the pre-industrial and now.
So what about emissions? Is it all about emissions?
It's mostly about emissions. And the remarkable thing, again, about the Paris Agreement is its near total political agreement behind it. 195 countries agreed to put their names to this document. The only countries that didn't sign it are Nicaragua or Syria, North Korea, and from what I can tell, the American Republican Party. So our conversation in the U.S. is a little bit different than it is in a lot of places.
That was Eric Roston from Bloomberg News.
That's all for this hour of Bloomberg Best.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm June Grosso. You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
Top-notch, value-added, hot-off-the-presses news.
Bloomberg puts out thousands of news stories a day, but some really stick with you.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day from over 150 news bureaus around the world.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter on this edition of Bloomberg Best.
Max Abelson tells the story behind Trump vodka.
One of the flaws here is that Trump chose to work with people who, may have had experience in the industry, but they didn't really have experience with launching beverages. And more importantly, they didn't have that much money, which would prove to be a problem.
Mike Moran talks about good investments in the pension space.
So I think this really highlights a lot of the challenges that many plans are facing today, and why in this environment we see many of them looking at a number of different tools in the pension risk management toolbox to help them address their pension deficits and funded status volatility.
And Lord Mervyn Alistair King tells us why central banks can't serve as the be-all and end-all for developed economies.
I think the problem is that central banks need to argue much more forcefully than they are doing that the answer is not monetary policy. I think the forays into negative interest rates are demonstrating that monetary policy is facing diminishing returns.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
So now we're heading off to Boston, to downtown Boylston Street, across from the Boston Common, a place that used to be the hub of piano dealers. So many piano dealers, in fact, it was called Piano Row. And in an industry struggling to stay in tune, well, there's one last piano store still standing. Bloomberg's Ann Mostu reports.
M. Steinert & Sons is a business on 4 floors of prime Boston real estate. It will soon move temporarily for renovations. But right now, it's still a creaky maze of rooms filled with gleaming ebony, mahogany, and rosewood grand pianos. Many priced at more than $100,000. Other pianos are rentals. There's a room of digital pianos. Then there are the workshops and lesson rooms and offices.
So these are all studios. There's Roxana's studio with piano teaching. This is my grandfather's old office. So this is Steinert Hall today. This is where we do performances today.
Brendan Murphy runs M. Steinert & Sons with his father, Paul.
So he moved down here, built this big building to be the hub of music, and it eventually drew all of the other manufacturers down to this block, and now this block is known as Piano Row. And we're the only ones left. We like to say, we're in an industry that's been dying for 100 years, but it has not died, and we're doing great.
Brendan's great-grandfather, Jerome Murphy, started here as a bookkeeper when he was just 16. But the Morris Steinert piano business dates back to 1860, the year Abraham Lincoln was elected. Steinert was selling pianos through the Civil War, even if it was a tough time to sell them. And the business kept thriving through the Great Depression.
At that time, we had 2 piano factories and 60-plus stores up and down the East Coast. So we were manufacturing our own pianos. We weren't only representing Steinway as we are today.
Steinert and Steinway sound similar, but they're separate entities. Steinways, made in New York and Germany, are widely regarded to be the best pianos. They're the choice of major concert halls around the world. Paul Murphy says that's part of his success, selling the best. He sells about 350 pianos a year. Of course, the piano business has changed since he came on board in 1970.
It was the, you know, the mother and father and 2.3 kids. We sold upright pianos to them. You look at the old sitcoms on TV, and you can see, like, 50s television, for example, you'll always see the set has a piano in the background. You don't see that. So that was the goal, was to reach those folks. And business today really is a lot more, for us anyway, it's a lot more grand pianos. It's to individuals rather than to families, I think. I mean, the person might be a family person, but they do buy it for themselves as much as for their family.
Pianos are instruments, but they're also furniture, antiques, works of art. Now about 20% of M. Steinert's business is with schools, colleges, and universities. Occasionally, a celebrity walks through the door. After all, this is the oldest Steinway dealer outside New York. So classical and jazz musicians take note.
You get a little starstruck here sometimes. Diana Krall played our piano, took our piano, our own piano, on tour throughout the country a couple of years ago, along with her 7-month-old twins in a bus.
And some of those stars have been involved with a new model, the Spirio. It's a grand and a player piano with professional recordings from Beethoven to Billy Joel. Brendan Murphy explains.
It's hard for a lot of families to justify having a large piano in their home if nobody's going to play it, or somebody's going to play it but not well enough to justify the price tag sometimes. This is a piano that they're going to be able to enjoy hearing because it's the top level artists literally performing on your piano, and also can be used for your kids to take lessons or for you to play. The first one that we got, we uncrated it on a Thursday and it was sold on Saturday. It's exciting. That's where we see the industry going.
It's a tough industry, especially as customers demand digital options. The Murphys say sales are back to what they were in 2007, so the recession appears to be over.
We're static right now. We're a little bit up from what we've been in the past 5 to 8 years.
Meaning the piano industry in general.
The piano industry in general. It was down following the housing market, I think, in that way. We have a very sensitive audience to consumer confidence. It's a discretionary purchase. Internationally, it's kind of the same. China's the growth market, probably up by 20%.
It's difficult to find statistics on the piano industry, partly because so many instruments are sold secondhand. In fact, the Murphys laugh when they say their biggest competition is the used Steinway. But the family business lives on. And good news, Brendan's two young children like pianos. Anne Mostu, Bloomberg Radio.
Coming up, Donald Trump vodka wasn't quite as huge as the presidential candidate might have hoped. We'll find out what went wrong.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best. Long before Donald Trump sold himself as a presidential candidate, he sold something else, vodka. But even calling the product the world's finest super premium vodka couldn't prevent it from being a massive failure. Bloomberg's Max Abelson talked to the man behind the bottle, and he shared the story with Bloomberg's Carol Masser and Corey Johnson on the Bloomberg Advantage.
So talk to us about how this happened and what lessons, we'll figure out lessons we can derive from this, but let's start with what happened.
Sure. So there was a beverages executive named J. Patrick Kenny, who I met. He was a very, very sweet guy. He was willing to tell me the story of Trump vodka, really for the first time. No one's ever told the story.
Yeah.
He was watching in the 1980s. I don't know if you guys remember this, but Bruce Willis was in ads for Seagram's, what's that
wine
sort of sweet
coolers.
Wine called? Yeah, wine coolers. Listeners can click on that ad on YouTube. It's still online. So Patrick Kenny saw this ad and he realized that celebrities and liquor could be a good combination. And so when he started a company called Drinks Americas, he, through a mutual friend, ended up going to Donald Trump and pitching him on this. And Trump accepted, but he didn't take a stake in Trump vodka. He just got fees. There was supposed to be $2 million by 2008 and more, although things didn't work out so well.
And talk about the debut. It was quite a flash. Big parties and there were...
Oh, yeah. It was, I feel like in my mind, it really typified the kind of like pre-financial crisis, you know, idea of glitz in sort of the U.S. culture. There were these debut parties with
Indulgence.
Indulgence, where Kim Kardashian was there just a few weeks before her sex tape was leaked. Khloe Kardashian, who would later be on The Apprentice, was there too. Paris Hilton. You know, Trump Vodka got off to a start, at least in a sort of a sense of spectacle. But, you know, really one of the flaws, and Corey, you asked about the lessons. One of the flaws here is that Trump chose to work with people who, you know, may have had experience in the industry, but they didn't really have experience with launching beverages. And more importantly, they didn't have that much money, which would prove to be a problem.
We'll talk about that, because the distillery that actually made the vodka, I mean, they had to kind of scrimp together money, right, to kind of get it all together ultimately.
Yeah, I talked to this real character in the Netherlands, Rene Vriens, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. Any Dutch listeners could, I'm sure, correct my pronunciation
there. Just message us. Let us know.
Rene said to me, look, I have a big mouth. I'm just like Donald Trump. So when he connected with the Trump Vodka people, he was like, yes, I'm the greatest Trump Vodka. I'm the greatest vodka producer. You should let me make Trump Vodka. But, you know, he had to like borrow supplies because the tanks that he had weren't big enough. You know, so look, I hope people read the story in Business Week, because sort of at every turn, things go wrong. You know, not only was there that distillery problem, but then, you know, there was a lawsuit over the bottle and there were issues.
A lawsuit over the bottle? What do you mean?
There was a lawsuit over the bottle. Milton Glaser designed the bottle and then it was produced, I believe, in Europe.
Milton Glaser, you know, famous graphic designer.
I love New York.
Exactly. I spoke to him. He was lovely. So the bottle was produced, I believe, in Europe. And then to save money, they moved the bottle production to China, which the original glass producers didn't appreciate.
So, and then, you know, the financial crisis came and that didn't help either, did it?
No, look, I mean, to be fair, there was some real bad timing here. You know, once the financial crisis came, this group did not have the money to keep things going.
That was Max Abelson from Bloomberg News talking with Bloomberg's Carol Masser and Corey Johnson on the Bloomberg Advantage.
Now it's time for our Bloomberg Best Legal Brief, exploring legal issues in the news.
Today on the Bloomberg Law Show, Michael Best and I discussed a Supreme Court decision that will allow victims of terror attacks to access $2 billion from Iran's central bank. We spoke with Stephen Vladek, a professor at American University's Washington College of Law, and Jimmy Garule, a professor at the University of Notre Dame Law School.
Stephen, let's start with the statute that was at issue here. What exactly did this statute do?
Sure. So, you know, as Jimmy can certainly speak more about, these plaintiffs had already obtained judgments against the Iranian National Bank arising out of Iran's role in funding acts of terrorism. And the question was, how could these plaintiffs execute on the judgments? Iran has a lot of assets in the United States. Those assets had actually been blocked by a series of orders from successive presidents of different administrations, so that even though these funds were here and even though these plaintiffs had a judgment, they couldn't execute on the judgment. And what Congress said in the statute was, in these specific cases and these cases only, the particular funds at issue could be used to enforce the judgment, notwithstanding the president's blocking orders. And the question that raised was whether Congress is allowed to basically create such a good for this case only kind of rule. Today, the Supreme Court, by a 6-2 vote, said yes.
Jimmy, explain the Supreme Court's reasoning in the majority.
Well, they advanced two important reasons. You know, first, they stated that changing the law with respect to a pending case and then affecting that law, or making it retroactive to affect and perhaps even change or influence the outcome in a pending case, did not violate the doctrine of separation of powers. And in an opinion written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she cited to a number of prior Supreme Court cases that had supported that proposition. And then second, the court stated that when the political branches, Congress and the president, work together in coordination in the field of foreign affairs, especially with respect to national security and combating international terrorism, that the Constitution affords the political branches plenary powers, broad authority, and generally the court should be deferential to the political branches in this field. And the court concluded, held that that's exactly what this legislation involved. It involved the president and the executive working together on the field of foreign affairs, and
the political powers, the political branches had constitutional authority to do exactly what they did in this case.
That was Jimmy Garule, a professor at the University of Notre Dame Law School, and Stephen Vladek, a professor at American University's Washington College of Law. They spoke with Michael Best and me on the Bloomberg Law Show.
The show's broadcast weekdays at 4:30 Wall Street time. You can find more legal news at BloombergLaw.com and BloombergBNA.com. And attorneys, you can find exceptional legal research and business development tools there as well.
Coming up, pensions just aren't what they used to be. We'll discuss the Goldman Sachs report that breaks them down.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm June Grosso.
And I'm Ed Baxter. Well, it used to be that you had one job for most of your life, you retired at 65, and then you lived happily through retirement on your pension. In today's economy, that's increasingly less common. Bloomberg's Taylor Riggs has more on the financial consequences.
Goldman Sachs Asset Management released its annual report on the top 50 largest corporate defined benefit pension plans in the S&P 500. Joining me now to discuss the annual report is Mike Moran from Goldman Sachs, who is the author of this report. Now, Mike, my first biggest concern about this is the top plans in the S&P 500 raised their discount rate. That makes liabilities look better. The problem is a flat return on plan assets still, and they're increasing their benefit payouts, which is leaving the funded ratio unchanged. So with all of those factors combined, how concerned are you about this?
Well, I think, Taylor, that really highlights the challenge for many corporate defined benefit pension plans today. Many of them have suffered under low interest rates over the last several years since their liabilities are valued based on market interest rates. As rates have stayed low, that has inflated their liabilities and hurt their funded status. So many of them were looking to higher interest rates as a way to help them alleviate some of the pressure on their pension deficits. To your point then, you know, last year we did see interest rates rise, but unfortunately there were other headwinds that they faced, namely number one, the low asset returns that you highlighted. Our work would say that asset returns for many plans last year was flat to slightly negative. And then as well, just the reality that many of these plans are paying out an increasing amount of benefit payments. So while a dollar paid out in benefits reduces assets and liabilities by the same amount, when you're underfunded, that dollar payment reduces your percentage of funded status. So I think this really highlights a lot of the challenges that many plans are facing today, and why in this environment we see many of them looking at a number of different tools in the pension risk management toolbox to help them address their pension deficits and funded status volatility.
So I know one of those tools in the toolbox that you mentioned is looking at their asset allocation. If we go back to 2015, many of them didn't change their allocation. They were hoping to get an update on the funded status before moving forward with any changes. Unfortunately, in your report, it looks like in the first quarter of this year, funded ratios got worse, not better. So what is the next step for these plans?
You're right, Taylor. I'd say in this environment, with funded status being low, asset allocation has not changed that much. So many plans in this country have some sort of glide path or journey plan in place that would say they are going to shift asset allocation as funded status rises. So as their funding gets better, they shift more out of equities or other return-seeking assets into more long-duration fixed income because that is the best match for their liabilities, and that helps them reduce the volatility of funded status. With funded levels remaining low, many did not effectuate those changes last year. What we're seeing plans do is to start to lay the groundwork for being able to effectuate those changes in the future. So while many of them are saying, today is not the day that I'm going to increase my fixed income allocation, many know that it's not something you can turn on a dime. They need to kind of make sure they get the procedures in place today so that when that situation, when that funded level is higher in the future, they can actually implement that. The other thing I'd say we're seeing plans do from an asset allocation perspective is just maybe looking to diversify more their portfolio. Equity returns post the financial crisis have been quite strong. Equity values have more than doubled since the financial crisis. But I would say with prospective return assumptions coming down, many plans looking to diversify away from equity beta. So a lot more interest in just how do I better diversify the return-generating part of the portfolio.
Let's talk about low interest rates. We have a very dovish Fed and negative interest rates globally. And you said that 40% of their plans reduced their expected return on assets assumption in 2015. Probably a good idea given where we are in this rate environment. Who are the leaders that are reducing those plan assumptions now as we look into 2016?
Yeah, I guess, Taylor, it depends on how we define leader. If we define leader as those who are really bringing them down a lot, that's one way to think about it. And within our report, we highlighted, for example, a company like FedEx, which reduced their assumption over 100 basis points for fiscal year 2016. In what we've seen over the past several years would be that the ones who have lowered it the most are the ones who have really become aggressive in de-risking their asset allocation, moving more to fixed income. Obviously, long-duration fixed income is going to have a lower long-term expected return assumption than public equities, real estate, and other asset classes that they may be reducing in order to fund that long-duration increase. So really, the ones that I would say that have brought it down the most are the ones that have made the most aggressive moves into fixed income. I mentioned FedEx in 2016, lowering their assumption by over 100 basis points. In 2016, we also saw a company like Caterpillar lowering it 50 basis points. And there are other examples like that as well. So this is a trend that's been going on for many, many years now. And it looks like based on some of the disclosures that we've seen for 2016 already, that trend will likely continue.
That was Mike Moran, a pension strategist over at Goldman Sachs Asset Management, on his annual report on the top 50 largest corporate defined benefit pension plans in the S&P 500. I'm Taylor Riggs, Bloomberg Radio.
And coming up, former BOE Governor Mervyn King tells us why central bank monetary policy is reaching its limits.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best. It's 48 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg View, the opinion section of Bloomberg. Here's David Shipley.
Imagine if states prohibited some citizens from voting based on their political beliefs. The reaction, justifiably, would be outrage. Yet about a dozen states already do exactly that, with hardly a word of protest. Much of the current national debate over voting rights is centered on overly stringent voter identification laws. But the single largest impediment to voter participation is the closed primary, which excludes anyone who declines to join a political party. In New York's primary, 1 in 4 voters were prohibited from casting ballots because they do not belong to either major political party. Next week, the same fate will befall independent voters in Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. Membership in a party should not be a prerequisite for equal access to the polls when the election is paid for by the public and administered by the state. Some states with closed primaries and caucuses permit independents to declare a party affiliation on the day of voting and then revert to their independent status after casting their ballots. This practice at least ensures that no voter is turned away because of his or her political beliefs. This editorial was written by the Bloomberg View editorial board. I'm David Shipley. For more View, please go to BloombergView.com and View Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Well, June, while world central bank policy differs from country to country, there's one thing many central bankers agree on. We are approaching the limits of monetary policy and, in doing so, risking major disequilibrium in world financial markets.
But as markets soften all over the world, investors and economies are increasingly falling back on central banks to stimulate economy, leading to high levels of economic stimulus and low or even negative interest rates.
Mervyn King, former governor of the Bank of England, sat down with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix to discuss the state of central banks all over the world and what central banks can do to help economies across the world.
In your book, The End of Alchemy, Lord King, you basically talk about reforming the financial system. Another point that you make is that central banks are taking too much of the brunt. They're taking too much of the weight. The problem is that it's now a vicious circle. You also, we seem to think that sometimes Janet Yellen is following the markets. How do you break the linkage between the central banks doing so much? If central banks were to stop easing, like the PBOC intimated today, would the world not crumble?
Well, I think central banks certainly couldn't jump to raising interest rates quickly. That would cause a further downturn. But equally, all that's happening now is that central banks are, when they take further easing measures, encouraging people to spend a bit more today at the expense of spending money in the future. You get a short-term recovery for a few months, then the future becomes the present. And then you've dug a hole in the demand in that period, and you have to do even more easing to try and keep economic growth going. And there's a limit to how long you can do that without diminishing the incentive to invest for what looks like an ever weaker future. So monetary policy cannot be the answer. It can buy time for a short period. Central banks have done well to buy 8 years, but the other policymakers involved have not responded. And I think the unwillingness to tackle this basic disequilibrium in the world economy is what is holding us back. And either the governments will summon the courage to deal with it soon, or we shall get into another crisis that may force governments to take those measures.
We're at a funny time because you talk about courage, but at the same time, politically, the sphere seems to have tilted to more extreme politics, either to the right or to the left worldwide. I'm thinking of the U.S. election, but it could be really cross-border. So again, is there a danger that actually governments are shy of putting structural reform, even emerging markets, because there's a sense that the world is far more unequal now than it was just 4 years ago?
Well, I think it's not surprising that voters have gone for extreme parties, because the centrist parties, whether left or right, have failed to produce a recovery and failed to grapple with the underlying seriousness of the situation. And I think, therefore, the anger, which didn't really come forth quickly after the crisis, but gradually built up, this is something that we foresaw and predicted. And I think it's not at all surprising that what we characterize as more extreme political parties are gaining in support. And this will carry on until governments summon up the courage to do something serious to rectify this basic disequilibrium.
Lord King, I know you don't want to talk about Brexit, out of respect for the person that came after you.
Indeed.
For the Bank of England. But have you modelled at all the effects? Or, you know, I don't know if it's a back of the napkin kind of equation, or if it's just so complicated that it would be difficult.
Well, I think one should be very cautious of precise numerical estimates of what the consequences would be. I'm old enough to remember the referendum in Britain in 1975 on exactly the same issue. And the one thing that both sides of the argument then were wrong about was that it would make a dramatic difference. It didn't. And I think that it's very important that people should not exaggerate the impact either of staying in or of leaving. And I do worry that proponents on both sides, treating this as a public relations campaign rather than a debate about the future of our country, are inclined to exaggerate because they feel they're selling a position. And what's more important is that we have a calm and reflective debate about the role of Britain in Europe. That's what it's about, and our relationship with a continent which we have struggled with for several hundred years. And this is a big, big question. It cannot be reduced simply to the level of a, you know, simple-minded cost-benefit analysis.
The end game is, though, for the world economy, huge, because it's seen also by the IMF as one of the biggest three risks facing us today.
I think, again, they're exaggerating. I think Europe as a whole faces two existential threats. One is the euro area, where the problems are still fundamental and haven't been solved. And the second is the migration crisis. Neither of these are easy to predict what will happen. They're outside the control of individual governments. But these are the big threats to Europe and hence to the world as a whole. British membership of the European Union is not an existential threat to the European Union or Europe as a whole. And I think it's important that people sort of calm down a bit and reflect on that. So there are big problems facing Europe, but British membership of the European Union is not the biggest risk or threat to Europe as a whole.
I know you talk about the risks and the downside risks to the world economy. You believe that we will see a crisis. Almost everybody believes there will be a crisis. Is it soon, or is it impossible to quantify?
I think it's impossible to say and to know. But what is very revealing about your question is that, you know, 8 years ago, when we were sitting in Washington agreeing among the G7 countries that we would engage in unprecedented measures to expand money, to ease monetary policy and indeed fiscal policy, that 8 years on, no one round that table ever imagined we'd be in a situation that we are today, where we are saying that we cannot seem to get a rapid world recovery, despite the loss of output in 2008-09, and despite the biggest monetary policy stimulus the world's ever seen. And if that doesn't make people start to question that monetary policy isn't the answer to the problem, I don't know what is.
But what are the underlying causes? China has a huge debt problem. We know, we cover it on this program every day. We talk about inflation and the fact that it's almost impossible to bring it up. I know you say we shouldn't worry about it too much. You have a huge energy crisis. We were talking about the emerging markets not really being there. Again, there are so many things that we need to sort out.
But I think one should look at the underlying development in the world economy over the last 30 years has been a persistent fall in long-term interest rates, especially real interest rates after adjusting for inflation. I do not see how a market economy can easily function when real interest rates fall to zero and have been for a period even below that. This is anticipated real interest rates over a long period. And the market doesn't expect these to get back to normal probably within my lifetime. This is a most extraordinary and unprecedented position we're in. And it's been the result of the interaction between policies adopted in different countries, in China for export-led growth, in Germany because they wanted to make a success of a monetary union by joining with countries that had not adjusted to their anti-inflationary discipline, to countries like the US and the UK that were determined to maintain growth and so cut their own short-term interest rates to offset the drag from a trade deficit that was coming through the policies adopted elsewhere. No one country designed this outcome, but the failure to cooperate and the failure to realize that the consequences of this was going to lead to a situation of very low real interest rates. This is the basic source of the problem, and we need to find a way of tackling it.
We need a Plaza Accord, but China would never be part of it.
Well, I think what we need is some agreement. I think the IMF could do a lot more to promote this, which would recognize that we need some kind of agreement about the timetable along which we need to take our own measures to rebalance our economies. It's very hard for us to be confident that we should take measures to rebalance our economy unless we're pretty sure other countries are going to do the same. In 2010, we tried to rebalance our economy, but the weakness in the euro area made that project one that didn't proceed along as speedily as we might have hoped. And we do need to see countries recognizing that unless they do their bit, then for every other country it's become more difficult.
That was former Bank of England Governor Lord Mervyn King talking to Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix about why we're putting too much pressure on central banks.
And that's it for Bloomberg Best tonight.
If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go.
Our program is produced by David Sucherman. Our technical directors are Jeannie Lucar and Jonathan Lauder. I'm Ed Baxter.
And I'm June Grosso. You've been listening to Bloomberg Best.